The House Resources Committee is called to order at 1:29 p.m. on Wednesday, February 8th, 2023. We are meeting in Capitol Room 124. Our end time is 3 o'clock this afternoon. I expect we will probably be done before that. Present are Representative Sadler, Representative Wright, Representative Rauscher, Representative McCabe, Representative Dibert, Representative Armstrong, and Representative Mears. I'm Representative McCabe, Chair of the Committee. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to do business. And are there any other legislators? I see we have no legislators in the audience. Thank you. I'd like to thank our recorder, Justin, and our moderator, Sydney, for helping us keep everything in order today. And if you have any other need any other assistance, my committee aide, Ed King, is available. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones. The goal of today's meeting is to learn about the permitting process in Alaska. The Office of Project Management and Permitting is an agency under the DNR designed to assist companies with the navigation of the complex process of getting a project approved for development. OPMP, which is one of the more unique acronyms I've heard, OPMP, is housed within the Department of Natural Resources but is funded through user fees. Members, this is an educational presentation meant for us all to better understand the due diligence our agencies undergo to ensure resource development is conducted responsibly. My goal is also to identify opportunities to reduce the administrative and cost burden facing companies contemplating the investment of millions, if not billions, of dollars in our economy without relaxing the requirements for responsible development. I encourage you to ask as many questions as necessary, time allowing, to fully understand this complex and complicated process. Now, moving on to the presentation, here with us today is Director Ashley Adoko, Acting Executive Director of OPMP. Director Adoko, welcome to House Resources. Please state your name at the table for the record and begin your presentation. And I should note that we also have several of your department on the line available for questions. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair McKay, and thank you, representatives, for this time today. I appreciate it. Yes, I'm Ashley Adoko, Office of Project Management and Permitting, Acting Executive Director, and I'm here to present the Alaska permitting process overview to you. So as we know, Alaska is home to large infrastructure projects, and those include mining, oil and gas, transportation, and others. We anticipate additional ones as well, including for broadband, energy, and others. So I'd like to start with a few visuals for examples, just to give a sense of scale and visual to you. And then I'd like to go over how it is determined what authorizations are required, because there are many. And then we'll go over also a list of potential required authorizations, and then some timelines, challenges, and streamlining efforts. So just for sense of scale and visual, here's an example of mine. This is Fort Knox. It's situated just outside Fairbanks. It's what we call an open pit mine. Then we have Greens Creek, which is in this area, an underground mine. Next, this is a visual of a oil and gas project on the North Slope, the Pika project. And then we have Fury. This is an example oil and gas project in Cook Inlet. And again, these are just a few examples, and so people have something kind of in their heads as we go through a little bit of this. So let's start with how it's determined what authorizations all these projects would require. It comes down to which agencies have management authority and which agencies have regulatory oversight, and authorizations are going to be required from each one that has one or both of those. And they will include state, federal, and local agencies, as well as sometimes private entities. And so I'll walk through what that means and then give a summary of some of the major agencies involved. So first off, who does have management authority in Alaska? Generally speaking, these are the landowners. And so we have generally state, federal, local, and private landowners in Alaska. And this map is a representation of the patchwork nature we have in the state, where there are many, many different ones abutting one another. It breaks down even further because within the state, we have these different state departments that manage different pieces of state land. And then you might say it even breaks down further than that in the state, because in TNR, we have our Division of Mine, Land, and Water, for example, as well as our Division of Oil and Gas, our Trust Land Office. Each of them, although they are within TNR and within the state, has its own authority and its own land pieces, so to speak. And so infrastructure that traverses any bits of their land within their jurisdiction will need authorizations from them. And then we also have federal agencies that have management authority in Alaska, as well as local and private. And then another thing to note regarding management authority in Alaska, we have split estates in Alaska. Most are probably familiar with this. That means that the surface and subsurface owners are often not the same. They're separated that way. And so one that owns the surface may not be the same and often is different than the one that owns the subsurface. And then I'd also like to note something about Alaska is that not only does an authorization need to authorizations need to be in place for infrastructure that's on the ground, but there's often need for access to that infrastructure or to build that infrastructure as well. And so additional authorizations for access. So in sum, who has regulatory oversight? So now we're stepping to not the agencies that have the land ownership or management authority, but the ones that have more of a regulatory oversight authority over activities. So that's our Department of Environmental Conservation, Fish and Game, DNR as well as being a landowner, our Office of History and Archaeology, our State Historic Preservation Office, and of course I've listed some federal ones here. So having said all that...
Excuse me, Director Representative Rauscher has a question.
Yeah, I was wondering, I think it's the bottom was what? The Office of History of Archaeology, the State Historic Preservation Office. As far as projects that can they, can you guys stop or delay projects with that department? And if so, under what authority can you do that?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, this is John Crow, the Deputy Commissioner of the Department. So the Office of History and Archaeology and the State Historic Preservation Office, OHA and SHPO, commonly used acronyms, fulfill both a state and federal role. There's a state law, the State Historic Preservation Act, protecting historic properties, cultural artifacts. There's similarly a federal law that identifies processes for protecting those artifacts. So that office is, its proper function is to review and consult with either federal or state agencies in the course of project authorizations to identify ways to protect and protect and mitigate impacts to historic and cultural artifacts. So it's, when properly applied, those authorities may shape or direct authorizations, but they should not prevent an activity entirely.
Through the chair. I'm sorry, through the chair.
That's all right. We're practicing today, George.
Follow up. Okay. So do you guys interact with the DOT on projects with the DOT? Because I think there are many out there that have been affected somewhat by probably the same organization. Maybe not, but something similar.
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, that's right. DOT has... As one can imagine, a variety of significant infrastructure projects that traverse large stretches of land. And one of the obligations they have is to comply with those state and federal laws. You know, obviously, some of their projects are funded by federal highway dollars. Some are state-directed projects. And in the course of that compliance, consultation with SHPO or OHA, the Office of History and Archaeology or the State Historic Preservation Officer, is required. The department has worked... we can discuss it at further length. The department has worked to improve the efficiency and transparency of those communications from our State Historic Preservation Office, because that can be a very complex process, and especially for a large DOT project that has critical timelines, it has been a source of some jurisdictional questions and timeline issues for those projects in the past. So.
Follow-up?
Okay, George.
Sure. I appreciate it. So I'm just wondering what projects are being delayed or impacted by SHPO, and I was also, would the DNR be willing to review impacted projects and provide a report for the committee? I think that there's probably some in my district that I'm kind of curious about, and I'm just wondering if statewide, maybe there might be also.
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, John Crowther again. We'd certainly be happy to identify a list of work the office has recently performed, projects that they've been consulted on, and further discuss and report that to the committee.
To the chair, just things like Amber Road and stuff like that. Just wanted to get a follow-up on all that and understand where they're all at is actually where I'm trying to go with that. And if they could give them to the committee, I'd appreciate it.
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, happy to work with you and the committee on that information.
Even though Amber's not in my district, but you know, I've got road projects and stuff. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you, Rep. Rauscher. I have Rep. Sadler next.
Very briefly, through the chair, Director Adoko, I noticed on slide 9 that North Slope Borough, Manuska Borough, and CBJ have management authority locally, but the municipality of Anchorage does not. Why is that?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, thank you for the question. This is not a complete list. So those, very good question. Those are examples. Sure. The others also have authority.
Okay, thank you, Rep. Sadler. Rep. McCabe.
Thanks. Through the chair, if we could go back to the SHPO and the slide 11 at the bottom there. So interested to know, maybe you have some examples, or maybe I didn't look much further forward, but of what is an artifact, who determines what it is, what is, a village. I mean, does just a hole that used to be a cache during the deny people's time, does that constitute, will that delay a project? How's that work when you find it and it gets reported to you? Do you send an archaeologist out there or somebody that's an expert? And maybe you could, this is, I think, what Rep. Rauscher is talking about, how a project can be delayed if some people don't want it to move forward. They can find an archaeological issue, and then what?
Representative McCabe, through the chair, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner here. I think it'd probably be most informative for the committee for us to just to do a workup about those existing statutes and regulations provided to the committee about, as you described in your question, what is an artifact, what are the processes for both assessing what artifacts may be there and then responding once an artifact or a historical site is identified, just so that we accurately describe it for the committee. Happy to provide that if we can get back to you.
Okay, I appreciate that. That's sort of up to Representative McKay.
Okay. Rep. Rauscher, you had a follow-up on that topic?
Yeah, just to piggybacking. I was just wondering if you could give us an idea on the costs of chasing artifacts for projects, whether they be DOT-related, whether they be DNR mining, just an average cost or maybe even a wide-range cost of chasing these artifacts, so we get an idea of the burden that presents to the state on projects. Thank you.
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, would be happy to try and get some information like that for the committee. As Director Adoka, I think we'll go into later in the presentation, projects can be very varied, and a significant highway extension or expansion can traverse a lot of land. Conversely, a particular site location project may occur in a well-characterized area from an archaeological sense. And so there can be great variability there, but we're happy to gather some information for the committee on that.
Thank you.
Okay, let me tie this up. Let's, Mr. Crowther, let's plan on having a future presentation on that topic. If you think that would be the best way to attack this.
Chair McKay, certainly happy to work with the committee to set that up.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? And we'll pause after each slide, Director Adoko, so we can give everybody a chance to kind of catch up. All right, please proceed.
Okay, so general list of major agencies that would be involved. And so as we'll recall, the topic being that these are the ones that generally, although it's not complete, will have either management authority or some kind of regulatory oversight authority. But examples again. Then let's go into what are the potential required authorizations. We've talked a little bit about the agencies that have authority. So let's get into a list. We'll have a list of some example potential authorizations. And then I have a few example projects in here so that you can get a slight sense of volume regarding how many are required for different projects. And then I'll touch on what an applicant or project proponent would want to do with this kind of information. So here's a general list of all the types of authorizations that could be required. And it's going to depend on the project, which ones. It could be a subset if there are lots of different combinations.
Okay, why don't we do an example? Could you tell us what held up the Willow project, for example, on this list? Would that be a simple question? Mm-hmm. Just for the help, for the education of my committee?
Yeah, Chair McKay, happy to, this is John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner, happy to speak to that a little bit, and I'll let my colleague Ashley Doko, of course, supplement. The Willow project itself is occurring in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, the NPRA, so federally managed lands to the west of Prudhoe Bay and the other state managed fields. Because of that, federal government, when it undertakes authorization for projects, has to complete authorizations under the National, NEPA, National Environmental Policy Act. That NEPA review results in what we often call an environmental impact statement, an EIS. And so for the Willow project, it went through that federal NEPA process to assess the propriety of putting it together a master development plan for the whole project, so the pads, processing facility, and pipelines. That master development plan, the environmental impact statement for it was developed over the course of years. In the course of those proceedings, it was identified that there needed to be a supplemental environmental impact statement because the project applicant, ConocoPhillips, was responding to community concerns about some of the original designs they proposed. So another multi-thousand page, multi-thousand hour, multi-hundred page review was completed, both the underlying EIS, that supplemental EIS, and that proceeded to ultimately a federal approval. We unfortunately saw litigation that challenged that project in a judicial ruling that said that those environmental review documents were insufficient in a few respects. Those related to assessments of greenhouse gases, consultation and assessment under the Endangered Species Act, or ESA. And so the Bureau of Land Management that had proceeded with those environmental impact statements, accepted a voluntary remand to revise that those federal review documents. And that's what we're in the final stages of, hopefully now, is a supplemental EIS to the supplemental EIS to the EIS that would address the items identified by the court, provide final authorization for ConocoPhillips to proceed with their project, and hopefully move forward. So in much shorter summary, that was a product of federal litigation and the federal reviews. But for the Willow project itself, there's a huge variety of authorizations. For example, once we hopefully, as we believe the federal government is responsible and required to do, issues a record of decision or ROD approving that project, hopefully within the next 20, 25 days, we would see state authorizations for the associated pipelines for that project proceed and be authorized by our state pipeline coordinator's office.
Okay, thank you for that short summary. I got to be careful what questions I ask. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. In terms of the short, I know you have 33 slides I want to get through them too, but just for terminology, through the chair, Director Adoko, can you describe the difference between an authorization and regulatory oversight? My understanding is that an authorization is before you can do anything, it's a general permit you have to get, and regulatory oversight is once you've gotten that permission, what regulates the specific activities. Is that a fair assessment or is there a differentiation?
Representative Sadler, that's through the chair. That's fair. The authorization is what we would call the document that allows you to do the activities that are described in that document. And I'll use the word, or I have been using the word authorization. I'm glad you asked, be somewhat broad because you'll say or you'll hear permitting. What does it take to get a project permitted, or what does it take to get through the permitting process? Well, in the state and probably outside the state, even systems, a permit is something really specific. It's a very specific type of document, and to distinguish a permit from something like a lease or an easement, we use the word authorization to cover all of the different types of ones that could be required. But then you're exactly right, Representative Sadler, that even after an entity gets the authorization to proceed forward, there is that regulatory oversight afterward.
Okay, Rep. McCabe.
Thank you, and this is probably going to be a really major question, or maybe not. Are all these regulations put in place by the department, statute, federal government? Requirements, or did somebody just sit at their desk once and dream up something and said, huh, maybe we should make them do this? I'm kidding, really, but how did they come into being?
Representative McCabe, through the chair, I will endeavor to be a little bit more brief than my last answer. in short summary, from the state perspective, you know, the state statutes promulgated by the legislature, enacted by the legislature pursuant to the constitutional authorities, are, as we understand it, the basis of all of our programs and subsequent regulations that we enact. So for the requirements we have for authorizations on state lands to do state activities through the department, we understand there to be a statutory basis that either says issue this kind of authorization or develop regulations that the department thinks are appropriate for this kind of authorization. And those regulations have to go through a public process to be enacted and to have the force of law, if that answers the question.
Okay, go ahead.
Thanks, and through the chair, yeah, I mean that's helpful, but I mean, what's the basis for it? You know, most of the time, a safety regulation that a department puts in place is because it's unsafe to do it a different way, or it's unsafe for the environment, or maybe it's in response to an oil spill. Hey, we have a new regulation now; you have to do this. So, what's the genesis, and have we looked at some reducing some of these permits and regulations because the genesis is no longer germane to us? Rep. Rauscher had a bill last year to reduce the, I don't even know what it had to do with, but it was like a 60-year-old regulation that was no longer germane because of the way we drill oil now. Mm-hmm. So are we looking at those to try to get rid of them? I mean, it's frustrating to us and our constituents that Canada and Australia and other countries can approve a mine in 3 to 5 years, and it takes us 20 years. So that's a little bit of my frustration, but maybe you can explain how the genesis actually works, or maybe it's in response to somebody that comes and says, hey, this could be a problem, or it might be a problem, or I don't like coal, or I don't like oil, or how do we come up with all the regulations that
Yeah. Representative McCabe, through the chair, John Crowther here. From the state perspective, particularly the DNR perspective, you know, we play two roles as landowner manager and in some cases as regulator. In the state system more broadly, an organization like the Department of Environmental Conservation is more a pure regulator as opposed to a manager. But as a general theme, as landowner, we're trying to maximize development. The Constitution tells us to do it. The law tells us to do that. So that means, you know, in state parks, more access for people to recreate. On state oil and gas lands, more drilling and development. On mineral potential lands, more mining and exploration. We certainly do have a complex regulatory, you know, management apparatus through our existing regulations, et cetera, that does need to be constantly assessed, constantly reviewed. We endeavor to do that within the department, but it's our obligation to respond to scrutiny from the legislature and the public when they raise ideas, whether it's outdated, overly complicated, expanded regulation. So that's from the department side and the state side. We certainly endeavor to do that. We do function within the reality that the federal government has significant regulatory authority. And many of the things that create significant challenges for Alaskans in a variety of uses, you know, access to lands, to development of lands, development of their own owned lands, can be federal regulations that are pursuant, promulgated pursuant to federal statutes, but also federal administrative agencies that, you know, frankly, the state litigates with those agencies at times because we believe they overstep their authority.
Okay, thank you, Rep. Rauscher.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Whoops. Maybe that was on purpose.
Appreciate it very much. Thank you to the chair. I was wondering, following along where Representative McCabe is heading there, but in a different direction, and I know your answer could be very easy and say, well, anything's possible with legislation, and I don't really want to go there. So what I want to know is what's possible with legislation. So if we have duplicity, you know, there are a lot of the problems with getting going, the 20 years or 8 years or whatever it's going to take us is duplicity between feds and the state. Is there any way along the lines of take the information the feds have and just call that good and say, yeah, we've got enough information over there. We don't really need to make go through the hoops again on this side. Is there a negative idea behind why you would not want to do that? I'm just trying to understand because I realize duplicity is part of the problem. Okay. And, can you address that at all?
Absolutely. Representative Rauscher through the chair. You know, I think there's been an effort at the department acknowledging that duplicity can be a very big problem for projects, whether it's a duplicity in standards or requirements to gather information, can extend or complicate timelines unnecessarily. So, we have endeavored to draw on federal information, respond to federal processes to avoid that duplication where we can. You know, it's as I said, it's an ongoing effort to continue to look at that. One of the functions of the Office of Project Management and Permitting is to assess kind of what, as a project gets started in the permitting process, what are all the things they're going to have to do and where can we avoid that duplication? If, you know, if they're going to have to gather this kind of information for DEC anyway, why don't they add just a little bit extra that they have to do for a federal permit, do it all at once so everyone can use the same information? So that the Office of Project Management and Permitting, we think, is a key part of that effort. But it's certainly, you know, we should always be assessing it. And I just add, as we just mentioned, the Willow Project. One of the reasons that those state pipeline authorizations will follow the record of decision is an effort to make sure our authorizations from the state side line up with the federal terms. So we don't have a, you know, we tell them to put it there and the feds tell them to put it there and they don't know what to do.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Crowther. I think as chair, I'll wrap this slide up myself. A lot of the things that we live under today started years and years ago. For example, Richard Nixon, President Nixon, established the EPA. And then we had Love Canal, which was a dioxin incident near Niagara Falls, New York. President Carter declared that an emergency, you know, a state of emergency in that situation. That caused a bunch of regulations. Of course, the Exxon Valdez spill, a lot of regulations came from that. Macondo, a lot of regulations came from that. So a lot of what we see here today on this list has been brought forward because of history, and the American people demanded that our water and our land and our wildlife be protected from major problems like that. And unfortunately, I guess, for industrial people, that means more regulations. So we better move on. Director Adoko, so you can get back on track, okay? Thank you.
Chair McKay, thank you. Ashley Adelko, associate with OPMP here today. So this is an example project, and again, they're all going to be different. This is to give you a sense of kind of what it might look like and for kind of volume sake as well. So it's been in existence for a while. 1996 is when it started producing. And in 2021, did some activities like road improvements and a little bit of construction and just to operate. It was about 25 major state authorizations to allow all of that to happen from these agencies here. And then we have an oil and gas example here. So this on the North Slope with some pads for drill sites, pipelines, roads, and operations facility, things of this nature. And it took 47 major state authorizations from the agencies listed here to authorize that. And so, again, just for sake of understanding a little bit of volume. And then broadband, we bring up because this is more of the hypothetical sense, this slide here. We envision long linear projects involving fiber optic, for example, sometimes towers. And while individually they will require multiples, it'll be even more important to look at them collectively because there will be so many going across the state in the coming years. So, oh, I'm sorry.
We're having a little, I'm watching Representative Wright because it's like an auction. You know, if you scratch your ear, you get called on. So just be really careful. Okay, any questions? Oh, I'm sorry, Rep. McCabe. Sometimes I don't see you right next to me.
Sorry. I appreciate that. Thanks, Director, and through the chair. I'm interested in the second sentence where it says Alaska Railroad Corporation. So there is heightened awareness on the rights of way that Alaska Air or Alaska Railroad Corporation is billing the state for, billing state agencies for. And I'm wondering what the statutory or regulatory mechanism is for the railroad to bill, say, the DOT for a right-of-way. And maybe that's outside the scope of what you're talking about right now, but I'm curious of where that comes from. I mean, does the DNR, does the state own the Alaska Railroad land, or does the Alaska Railroad own it? How can one state agency bill another state agency for a right-of-way is kind of what I'm interested in finding out.
Representative McCabe, through the chair, I do think we'd want to confer just to make sure to give the committee accurate information about the nature of the railroad's ownership. It's my understanding, although, again, we need to confirm it, that the Alaska Railroad views that they have a suite of ownership rights over their land that they independently manage. Apart from the Department of Natural Resources, we don't oversee the railroad rights-of-way. But we'd be happy to get back with the committee with the legal basis for those different
management. That'd be great. Authorities. Thanks.
I can tell you, Rep. McCabe, that the railroad has what they call an exclusive right easement, which they actually won in federal court recently. But I'm not a legal expert, so I probably better not say any more than that. But they did win in federal court recently on their exclusive use easement along the entire railroad. Okay. Director Adoko, please.
Thanks, Chair McKay. So volume and broadband is what I was mentioning a little earlier. So collectively, individually, they will require, we picture, and it's, of course, project specific, but individually, broadband projects are anticipated to need authorizations from, of course, everyone who has land management authority. And anyone who has, again, that regulatory oversight for any activities they're doing. So with the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act funds coming into the state and a lot already being here, we anticipate there being just an increase in volume of infrastructure for broadband in the coming years.
Okay. Any questions? No. Okay, please proceed.
So this is just about what project proponents would do with this information. I think folks are probably aware, but just to note that for every authorization that is required, there's an application that needs to go into the appropriate agency and processes and requirements that need to be complied with for each one of those. And so with that being said, a little bit of this at the end goes somewhat to the streamlining concept where pre-application meetings informational talks with our regulators and then submitting complete applications at the outset is something that can really help move projects along. And then when agencies have additional needs for information, responsiveness to those is another thing that moves them along. And with the understanding that changing a project and its location can, because it could affect different authorities, necessitate starting different processes over again, needing new authorizations or starting analysis or review kind of from the outset.
Okay, thank you. Please proceed.
Okay, so a little bit about timelines and challenges in Alaska. So generally speaking, large infrastructure projects, as folks have talked about, take years to authorize. So I'll give a little bit in terms of examples in the mining and oil and gas context, and then put that in context of the entire project as well, because authorizing permitting is only one piece of the all the stages together. And then I'll touch on NEPA, what John, our Deputy Commissioner Crowther, was referring to, National Environmental Policy Act. I'll touch on that because it's something that most projects will, they will involve that. And then we'll touch on some challenges. So in context then, generally a mining and oil and gas project are, they're somewhat similar in that there's going to be various stages. They'll start with exploration, and then they're doing studies, and this will include environmental and feasibility type studies to help them decide whether it's worth their time and effort and money to move forward. And then they'll go into their design and engineering work, and then their financing, and then their permitting. These overlap as well. Finally, constructing, operating, and ultimately closure and post-closure. I bring that up because the focus here is, of course, the authorizing, the permitting step, but it's one piece, one stage of the whole getting the project from start to finish. And these are examples. These are just to show the length and then just also the fluctuating nature, the project-specific nature that makes each one take different amounts of time. And then, oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, can we just run through that one real quick? Yeah, sorry to interrupt you there, Director. John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner, just to run through this slide really quickly, you know, these are projects that are of importance to the state and people. You see Greens Creek there, an expansion of that mine, and that, you know, is identified in the slide. Expected to have a bit of a, probably close to a four-year review process there, and that production to start up, you know, there's a significant period between the, what has hopefully the authorization and the production. Similarly for Kensington, another operating mine here in Alaska, the 2019 expansion, 3 years for the issuance of the rod, and then quick startup on that, and that's that, that difference between different projects have different timelines you can see there. Similarly, very different timeline for the Donlin project, not an operating mine, but an advanced exploration project and prospect with the identified development plan. The NEPA there began in 2012, 6 years for the record of decision to be issued, but the project is still working on identifying a plan for construction, financing, and ultimately development. Moving into the oil and gas space, we have the Willow project. We just ran through that for the committee, but 2017, and we're still awaiting a final record of decision and approval there. The PICA project, the 3 years of NEPA review there, 2016 to 2019, but we've now received those authorizations, received the necessary permits. The final state permits are underway right now, and we have a project sanction and expected start up in the 2026 timeframe. an example of a project, an oil project that is underway right now, at least in different stages, Greater Moose's Tooth. The unit originally formed in 2008 on the federal MPRA lands. The record of decision issued 2015 for the GMT-1 project, I believe, and then that first oil followed 3 years later. And there's kind of a rolling review of GMT projects. Most recently, we saw first oil of GMT-2, Greater Moose's Tooth 2, in 2021. And then finally, a project that is the Nuna project, and that is discovered, has been transferred several times. And then now, after about 10 years, the ConocoPhillips, the current operator, is working to advance that, and hopefully we'll see first oil there in the near future in the next couple of years.
Okay, so Rep. Dibert.
Through the chair, thank you, Deputy. I don't know if this is the right time to ask this question. I'm representing Fairbanks, and I was just wondering, when we're talking about timelines for Mann's show, do you know where we're at? Is this a good place to ask, or where we can get more information? Thank you.
Sure, Representative Dibert, through the chair. We have also given some information that's headed your way, I think, on Moncho and a few other of our mines as far as timelines and where they are concerned. Moncho is in the stages of getting their state authorizations. They're applying now and working through that process. And so public notice is yet to come on that. And then after, if authorizations are issued, they would be moving forward under the terms of those.
Okay. I have a question real quickly. I didn't go back and look at the earlier slide where these were all categorized as federal or state, but I thought PICA was a state project. We still have to do NEPA on state projects. Why is that?
Chair McKay, that's right. It is state, primarily state-owned land. There's also some private Alaska Native corporation-owned land under that project. The requirement for doing the NEPA, the federal review there, is there is a federal regulatory authority through the Army Corps of Engineers for what's called 404 permitting. That's where a wetland is disturbed. The federal government has asserted authority to manage the nation's wetlands because they're waters, and there's a federal regulatory power over the waters of the United States. And so that requires getting a permit through the Army Corps and a multi-year NEPA process, even though it's on state land.
So to say it in street terms, all it takes is one aspect of the project to touch a federal regulation, and then that pulls you into that whole process. I mean, you can't avoid it.
Chair McKay, that's for a significant development project, that's very often the case.
Okay. Rep. Sadler.
Thank you, through the chair, Director Adoko. So mining and oil and gas leases have a finite shelf life. Does this permitting process, if it can take a long time, does that eat up the time available to actually make use of the lease?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that, Representative Sadler, through the chair.
Yeah, Representative Sadler, through the chair, that is certainly the case. That, you know, from the state perspective, oil and gas leases are for a set term. Mining claims and the rights associated with them and the potential conversion into mining leases often have a more extended term in recognition of the extremely extended permitting process. But for both of those entities, these permitting timelines materially affect their ability to use their rights, whether it's from the duration of the right itself or just from the commercial reality of trying to make a project work. So the timelines are very relevant.
So if I can say that in street terms, if I invest millions of dollars in some oil leases and the term of the lease is 10 years and it takes 8 years to get the permits, I've got just 2 years to actually go out and drill. Is that seems a little bit unfair, I guess, if I'm an investor. In fact, it seems really unfair.
Chair McKay, I think it is fair to say that's a significant constraint for operators. The department, and apologies for not using perhaps more simple street terms, but the department works to allow extensions for leases. We also work to unitize leases where they can have an extended life. If a developer is identified, even in the potential exploration scenario with potential hydrocarbons. So on the state land, we work to try and respond to this timeline as much as possible. One of the challenges we have is our federal landowner partners often don't pay as close attention to those timelines, and so those NEPA timelines can really challenge projects.
Okay, thank you very much, everybody. Director Adoko, please continue.
And then I'll just touch on here, so we've talked a little bit about timelines for mining and oil and gas projects. This is related to the broadband projects that we're foreseeing coming in the future. There are strict timelines associated with the dollars that fund those projects. So it depends on the source, but generally 3 to 5 years is what's required. And then here's a note on essentially what Deputy Commissioner Crowther was talking about earlier. Under NEPA, if there's a federal action or federal funding involved, a NEPA analysis has to occur where federal action is an authorization that's required from a federal entity, for example. So if a permit is needed, like the one that Deputy Commissioner Crowther mentioned, which is a very common one in our state, it's going to trigger NEPA.
Okay, Rep. Rauscher has a question.
So, thank you, through the chair. National Historic Preservation Act and the how the feds operate in this regard, is that even more lenient toward what is accepted than what the state may accept as something that would hold up a project? Or where are they? I mean, where are you all on that? I'm trying to figure out each one's role and how much one may have more supersedive power than the other, or whether one's even more powerful than the other.
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, I think perhaps it might be most informative to your question in the committee for us to, when we do the presentation about the SHPO, to do a summary of the respective authorities, state and federal, how they're the same and how they're different. As for the purposes of the federal authority, it's a bit of a complex system where the federal agency that's conducting a review or issuing a permit is required to consult under what's called Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act, required to consult with the state historic preservation officer about how to appropriately protect artifacts under the federal law. So those state employees are performing both a federal and state function. Those laws are often very similar in their requirements. But as you can imagine, a federal agency may choose to take a very protective approach because of how they view their federal obligations and authorities.
Just a quick follow-up.
Okay.
Even on state land?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, that can be the case on state land in the course of a federal authorization that's required for a project on state land. So, for example, a 404 permit for the wetlands, as we described, that may involve the Army Corps having to do a consultation and identify those things to issue their federal permit, even though it's state land.
I thank you. Appreciate it.
Just a real quick tangent off of that, Mr. Crowther and Director Okoto. The state is trying to take the primacy on 404 away from the Army Corps. Is that correct? So we could manage that ourselves. That's the objective of that other bill.
Chair McKay, yeah, it's possible for states to assume primacy of the 404, Section 404 of the Clean Water Act program, which is where a state runs, administers that program, and issues those permits. One of the requirements of primacy is to go through a process with the Army Corps and EPA for that approval. So there, you know, we don't get to entirely set our own standards. We do have to mirror the federal standards, but that would give us the authority for the specific decision making and the issuance of the permit and prioritizing the timeline that is important in getting those permits out.
Okay, thank you for that. Please continue, Ms.
So Ashley Adoko, Office of Project Management and Permitting. And there are different levels of NEPA review. This is the general overview here. So most projects in Alaska are going to go to the environmental impact statement stage. And it's determined by the federal agency. They can, in some instances, say they've defined certain actions that they will say are categorically excluded from this analysis because they've determined that that type of project doesn't have a significant impact on the environment. And then the next level is what they call an environmental assessment. And then the next level is the EIS. And you can probably imagine the timelines kind of tick up with each heightened analysis. So challenges, back into the context of what challenges might we face here in Alaska. So the first one being volume. I might say the first bullet under volume goes more to the applicant perspective. So large infrastructure projects involve many agencies often. And then from our adjudicator's perspective here in the state, they process many, many applications for authorizations, and there will be additional applications with any new mining, oil, and gas projects, and then especially with the addition of the infrastructure that's coming as a result of the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. So another challenge we have, we've kind of wrapping up a little of what you folks have already brought up and with Deputy Commissioner Kova here, timelines are another challenge. They can take a long time. With broadband and projects that come with federal funding, the timelines are set in federal law and they're strict. Let's see, the last challenge being that there are non-state agencies involved in many of the projects, federal agencies that are involved in many of our projects. So streamlining efforts, I'll go over these rather quickly. The first one is in reference to my office, the Office of Project Management and Permitting. This is our mission statement here, the first bullet, and it's our one of our core missions to assist in navigating these processes and working with the agencies and the applicants reading too much here. I'll speak a little bit more to us generally and then also go over some of the efforts that our DNR folks have been taking. So generally speaking, we support many. We support our applicants, our regulators, the public. We help work through these processes. We're an optional service. We're unique here and we've been here for more than 20 years. So we've got a good amount of Alaskan experience. And we currently support mining, oil and gas, transportation, and other large infrastructure projects. The next slide speaks a lot to what our Division of Mining, Land, and Water has been doing, and especially regarding the incoming broadband applications that they anticipate processing. And the next slide speaks to what our department has been doing, generally speaking, regarding oil and gas projects.
Yeah, I read kind of slow, Director, so you might have to slow down just a little bit.
Sure.
Or should I make Representative Rauscher read these slides too?
I think of that.
And Chair McKay, just
go ahead, Mr. Crowther.
A little bit of information about this slide. You know, the department has been working to streamline authorizations and have consistency, and one of those ways we've done that is through the Department or the Division of Oil and Gas working on all oil and gas authorizations. So that's been under what we call Department Order 21, providing clarity between DMLW, the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, and DOG, the Division of Oil and Gas. And so that's some of the things mentioned on here are the Division of Labor internally we've been doing to make it efficient for project proponents when they come to the department to know who to talk to.
Rep. Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the Chair, Director Adoko, or Deputy Commissioner Crowther, I'm going to invite you to toot your own horn a little bit. One of the slides, one or two back, said the OPUMPS services are optional. What is the reputation among the resource development community about OPUMP and its work and what benefit it brings to the system? And I guess an ancillary question would be, why would any large infrastructure project not want to use OPUMP services?
Well, Representative Sadler, through the chair, John Crowther here, I'll brag about Ashley and her team a little bit so that she doesn't have to. But of course, I'll let her supplement that. I think that we've seen a very robust support, appreciation, and engagement with OPUMP, even though it's voluntary across industries, and that's because of the value added they provide in identifying authorizations that are needed up front, syncing up timelines, and ensuring that the state agencies meet those timelines. And when federal agencies don't meet those timelines, that there's an organized and collected state voice asking why and providing the information that may be needed to bring those things back in line. As part of the explaining a little bit more about the voluntary service, any project developer, large, small, individual, can come to the state and seek permits. What the Office of Project Management and Permitting does is attempts to, for projects that are interested, that opt in, be a one-stop shop to speak about what permits are required. They describe their project to the OPUMP coordinators, the OPUMP leadership, and the OPUMP team, And then they identify, oh, you need to talk to Fish and Game about that kind of authorization. Here's the right person. You need to get this kind of authorization from DEC. Here's those statutes and authorities. Here's the information you need to get. So that's the service that's provided. And as part of that service, the state, you know, compensated for that service by project proponents having to reimburse the state for those expenses. And so we really view it as a win-win-win. We have an improved coordination, but we also don't use public resources. You know, private developers use their resources to get the benefit of that service.
Okay, Rep. Rauscher has a question.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, gravel extraction, in the private sector, just wondering, permits could take anywhere from 6 weeks to 6 years, and I'm just wondering why that may be. I know of those that are probably at least 3 or 4 years in the making right now out in Sutton. I'm just wondering what the what's the criteria there on those differences.
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, it might be best if we could get back some information to you about those specific authorizations, if we can follow up with you. It's my understanding that the different authorizations to access state materials, develop gravel, can be very varied. You know, there can be small projects, there can be use of existing pits, but there can also be, silly to say exploration, but essentially exploration to try and characterize new gravel resources in frontier areas and develop them. And so I think that may be part of the different timelines we see, but happy to get both the requirements for those authorizations and what we've seen in timelines back to you.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Okay, Representative Dibert.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. Director Adoko, is there a place online where we can see a list of agencies that you coordinate with?
Representative Dibert, through the chair, that's a great question. We have our website up, and if you go there, you can click on projects that we coordinate. Not all of them are represented there. And then from there, you'll see some of the main ones that we coordinate with. It's very mainly DNR, DEC, and Fish and Game, but they're not all represented in any one place.
Thank you.
Okay. Please continue.
Sure. And thank you, committee. And I would love, if I could, the opportunity to say that OPMP functions because we have such great staff in OPMP. We depend on them and the agencies that we support and our applicants as well. And it really is a team effort that makes everyone move toward the same goal. And so love to call them out if I could. Thank you. Okay, let's see. And then we are all working together with the broadband office as well as other funding sources, and then our state and federal agencies and others to sort of approach the incoming broadband applications together and looking for ways to coordinate together. On top of that, we're in contact ongoing basis with the infrastructure office so that we can foresee other incoming infrastructure projects and possible needs for coordination. And this is my final slide today. I have some takeaways. So as we know, Alaska is home to large infrastructure projects, many mining, oil and gas, and others. They involve many agencies and many authorizations. There's no one authorization that allows the whole thing, and many more projects are anticipated. And we're here to assist as an optional service. And thank you so much for the time today.
Okay, thank you, Director. Any final questions? Okay, thank you for your presentation. We've learned a lot today, and I sincerely appreciate your willingness to educate us. It sounds to me like a lot of work has been done to streamline the permitting process, but I always wonder if there is more we can do. One action item that came out today was to report back to us, Director Crowther, on the archaeological and artifact questions that were previously asked.
Yes, sir.
So work with staff on that, please. And thank you for that. Is there any other business from the committee? All right, seeing none, our next meeting will be 1 o'clock Friday, February 3rd, when we will hear from the DNR about carbon sequestration, which is HB 50. I would suggest that the committee members have a look at that bill. Please bring your questions. Obviously, that topic's receiving a lot of attention, and I'm sure that you'll have a lot of curiosity about HB 50. So that'll be on Friday. The meeting is adjourned at 229. 229. About that? Thank you.